Okay.
Okay. So, yeah, last time, in the first year, two nights ago, we started discussing the first half of the Sugya of the Pitzur of Karka Olam. And, you know, the aspect of the Sugya that we were focusing on was the scope of Karka Olam, right? In which contexts does the Pitzur of Karka Olam apply? So we discussed two potential contexts. One context discussed by the Baal HaTosos is the context of the Gimel Averos Chamuros, specifically Gilui Arayos. That's what Tosos bring up. That was one discussion. And then the second discussion, which already comes up in the Gemara, Sanhedrin Ayin Dalet Amud Beis, is whether the Pitzur of Karka Olam applies in the context of Far Hesker. Right? That was last discussion for last time. So now I'd like to transition to discuss a second issue in regards to Karka Olam, and that's really, I guess, getting more to the core, like the lundus, the nature of the Pitzur of Karka Olam. And really the basic question of why. Why does the halacha of Yehar Layavur not apply when the person is karkola, when the person is passive? You know, what impact does passivity have on the application of Yehar Layavur? So we're going to present three different approaches in the Mefarshim as to what exactly the nature of the Pitzur Karka Olam is. And as we discussed last time, the nature of Pitzur Karka Olam might depend on the specific context. So first we're going to discuss the nature of the Pitzur in the context of the Gimel Averos Chamuros, and then we're going to discuss the impact in the realm of Far Hesker. There might be some overlap, but it's important to discuss each one separately. So first, in terms of the Averos Chamuros, right? Three different approaches in terms of what exactly the nature of the Pitzur is. So the first approach, as we already referenced last time, is that when the person, let's say the Isha, for in our case, the Gilui Arayos, when the Isha is completely passive, it's as if the Maisa Avera is not Mitzurav to her.
What does that mean?
Meaning that halakhically, we do not define her as having violated the Avera if she is completely passive. Right? The idea would be, right, in the realm of Yehar Layavur, is that when you're actively doing the Avera, so then the Avera is accrued to your record, right? As Mitzurav is connected to you. But if you're completely passive, so then we treat it as if you didn't do the Avera, it's as if it's not Misyaches, it's not connected to you at all. So that would be the first approach, which should say, and therefore in the realm of Averos Chamuros, that if you assume that the Mechayev of Yehar Layavur, of the Averos Chamuros, is the fact that you cannot violate these Averos under any circumstances, even at the threat of Pikuach Nefesh, so then the exception of Karka Olam would be that, oh, when you're passive, we don't consider as if you violated the Avera. So far, so good. So again, the reason why there's no Yehar Layavur for Karka Olam is because when you're completely passive, we don't treat it as if you violated the Avera. Before taking any questions, just to explain which Shita seems to accept this approach. As we hinted to last time, this seems to be the Rivam. So remember, the Rivam, the first day in our Tosos, is the one who basically was spelling out that it was more pashit to apply Karka Olam to the realm of the Gimel Averos Chamuros than it was to the realm of Far Hesker. And right, that's why he explains the Gemara. The Gemara doesn't need to ask about the Ha Esther Gilui Arayos Havai, because of course there's the exception of Karka Olam when it comes to Gilui Arayos. The only question the Gemara has is whether that Pitzur of Karka Olam will also apply to the realm of Far Hesker. So we get to the Far Hesker in a moment, but it's clear from that distinction of the Rivam between Gimel Averos Chamuros and Far Hesker that the nature of the Pitzur of Karka Olam when it comes to Gimel Averos Chamuros is unique, and it's very specific to the Averos Chamuros. Nothing to do with, you know, Chil Hashem. It's very specific to the Averos Chamuros, and the simple way to explain it is that when you're passive, the Avera is not Mesiachis to you. So that's Pashit when it comes to the Averos Chamuros. But the Gemara is still then asking, what about Far Hesker? Far Hesker seemingly has nothing to do with, you know, let's say the Maisa Avera. It has all to do with the Chil Hashem. And therefore the Gemara then has to ask, oh, do you also have a separate Pitzur of Karka Olam for that distinct context of Far Hesker?
But by Resicha, we give a very specific reason of who says my blood is more important than your blood. So that was the reason. Why would it be anything to do with it?
So, yeah. For the moment, let's leave this to, you know, the Gilui Arayos and not to Ritzicha. Just one time. Okay. Yeah.
I mean, how would you compare it to
the case of like bestiality, where the animal can theoretically be passive, but you still kill it. It's still as if it.
Yeah, so that's a completely different halacha of takalo or kalon, mm-hmm. which is basically nothing to do with the animal having violated an avera as much as either it's an embarrassment to the person for the animal to be walking around alive, or it's the fact that because it was through it that the person violated the avera. So that's the whole sugya in Sanhedrin of either kalon or takala, not against that, but that's a separate issue. Okay. So again, so the first approach to the nature of karka olam when it comes to the gimel averos chamuros is that it's as if the person didn't violate the avera because she or they were passive. That's the first approach. The second approach, which is presented by Rav Hanan in Kovetz Arus, I'm not sure if guys are able to see this because my guys are able to find it, but I guess the Bar Ilan guys, you know, Tani and Yom. Anyone want to take a crack at it? I don't mean to penalize you for having access. You don't have to if you don't. Do you remember offhand? It's a trigger. Okay, maybe it'll trigger your memory. So Rav Hanan develops a different approach to the Patur of Karka Olam, something which might sound familiar based on Reb Chaim. And basically, the way the Rav Hanan sets it up is that when it comes to the Gimel Averos Chamuros, he says, don't think as follows, right? The classical way of understanding, one of the classical ways of understanding the Mechayev, the Har Layavor, when it comes to the Gimel Averos Chamuros, is that in contrast to Shar Averos, which are Nitcha, or Nitcha is Bifnei Pikuach Nefesh, like B'makom, Pikuach Nefesh, B'makom V'chai Behem, that's Docheli Averos. But in contrast to Shar Averos, when it comes to the big three, the way most people, a lot of people learn it, is that, oh, these Averos are so chamur that they even apply B'makom Pikuach Nefesh.
The first Pshat says that.
Well, that's the way a lot of people say it. The Rav Hanan says, that's not what's going on. What's really going on, it's not that, oh, the Avera is Doche, you know, so these Gimel Averos are Dochos at, meaning the factor of V'chai Behem, but rather that there's a stalemate. That V'chai Behem / Pikuach Nefesh is in a tie with the Avera. And because there's a stalemate, you just can't do anything. You're frozen. Which, if you recall, this is similar to Reb Chaim's idea in terms of the Svara of Maichazis, where, you know, the two lives create a stalemate, you just can't do anything. So Reb Chanan says that notion of a stalemate, and therefore you're just frozen and you just can't do any Maisa, that's pshat in all the Averos Chamuros. Because the idea in all the Averos Chamuros is that there's a stalemate, there's a complete tie, there's a standstill between the factor of a Chai Behem and the factor of the Aver, and therefore you just can't take a stand. You can't do anything. Therefore you just must be passive.
That makes perfect sense with the Svara.
Exactly. And the Chiddush is that he even extends it to Gila Rayos and to Avodah Zarah, which nothing to do with the Svara. It's just that there's like a complete stalemate, standstill between the Avera Chamura and the factor of a Chai Behem, and therefore you can't take a stand, right? You can't save yourself to favor a Chai Behem because is the Avera on the other hand. And you can't do the Avera because you have a Chai Behem. Therefore, you just have to be completely passive.
But why can't you do the Avera if you have...
But you can't do it with Maisa.
The Chai
Behem. Because it's like a stalemate. Neither one is Docha.
Okay.
And neither one is Docha the other, so therefore you can't take a stand. Because you can't... By doing a Maisa and, you know, taking one choice, you're taking a stand. And you say, oh, I'm favoring the Chai Behem. That's if you do the Avera. Or if you say, oh, I'm going to take a stand and, you know, do a Maisa and be killed, but then you're going against the Chai Behem.
So this is like Reb Chaim's first understanding of the Svara.
Exactly. So this, yeah, exactly. It's a parallel notion of a stalemate, you just can't do anything.
So this has to do with, what's interesting is that this has to, the outcome is that you are more concerned about transgressing the Avera than living. In other words, you're
because you're just from your perspective.
Sure. No, yeah. Naturally, but uh-huh. The
you're right. The Avera will end up.
That's interesting.
In,
that's interesting. The Chai Behem is how's it formulated in the pasuk?
Meaning, the pasuk says
the pasuk. It's formulated
in the context of mitzvos. It says the Chai Behem.
It's an imperative.
Yeah,
that's very.
So
very,
we
okay,
learn
so
out
that is very that's
the low shayamas.
Yeah, so that I mean that's that's pretty narrowly, I mean, this is a, you know, I'm not saying anything new, but this is a, it's what is it? Yeah, sure, what is it? Yeah, it's just formulated as an imperative, that's what I've, right, yeah, I mean, it's not, just from the perspective of, like, psychology of halacha, there's some mitzvot that are, like, outcome dependent, whether you perform them, but it's not, like, it's not formulated, I think it's significant that it's not formulated as survive. That you may perform mitzvot. It's yeah. But what's interesting is that it's not obvious. That could get like adarabba. Okay, all right. Hold on. I have a havamina. You know, like, what if you think that the like, why shouldn't you be required to? And maybe this would just lead to like a further stalemate. But I don't know why passivity should be the response. Shouldn't you be required to live at all costs? Like, why?
But that's the point. That value of chaybeh is up against the counter value of the severity of the avera.
Sure.
So therefore, you can't take a stand.
Uh-huh.
I mean, therefore, those two values, which are, you know...
Everyone agrees that if you do it actively, so you have to give up your life. So over here, it's just...
You just can't take a stand. You can't take any action which will take a stand on which one you're favoring, because there's a complete standstill.
So if you so if you were forced to, let's say, never mind, I'll work this out.
So. For the same reason that we say by my chazus you can't choose either way. It's the same type of thing.
Exactly, you can't choose.
But like I thought that might be because really one is better and you just don't know which one. No?
That's when it came to the svara. So but here it's a different idea. And again, there are different ways to learn the svara itself. But okay. I mean, the svara itself, according to some, it's not that. Oh, you can't. There is someone more valuable you can't choose.
Oh, by myself.
Some people say no. It's just that no. You know, fundamentally, you know, all lives are of equal value.
That's why here can you choose that?
No. But here we're just saying it's just the severity of the avera versus the severity of a chaybehem.
Right.
And the halachic, you know, system is telling us that din avera le'avor is that you can't take a stand on this issue because those two values are of equal value.
It's like they're just as bad as each other. You could pick which one.
No, that's the point. You can't mean because the Torah, because the halachic system says they're both of equal value.
You don't know which one's
you can't. Now even though you don't know, you can't. You have no right to take a stand.
And I mean,
you just have to be passive and let the chips fall.
I feel like it's different with the okay, fine.
I remember like hearing like a story on like the Holocaust. You know, like someone had to pick which one to let out or whatever. So is that something to say? Is that
that comes up? That's part of the larger topic of the svara is this issue of you have to let someone go. That's part of the Sheva ben Bichri, Real Dave Sugya. That's still on topic. We discussed this a little last summer, but it's a little beyond the scope.
If we have a Gzeiras HaKasuv that says that Harga Olam is okay, being passive is okay, why do we need to, like...
Well, there's no Gzeiras HaKasuv, but... Yeah. This is only, that's the point. There's no Gzeiras HaKasuv.
Well, yeah, the Svara, and from the Svara branch out...
The Gemara just says it. Not everyone's trying to now figure out why. Right, if there's a Gzeiras HaKasuv... Anyways, we'd like to figure out what Gzeiras HaKasuv is. The meaning is, but anyways, there's no clearest cause of karkol.
But the point, the it starts the svara, correct? By your recite, by resicha. Isn't that the source of all of it?
Okay.
And we
say, that's Tosus's raya to it.
Right, and from that svara, we transfer it, so to speak, to the other gemara gemaras.
Okay.
So then, wouldn't the svara behind all three just be that it's by resicha because of that svara, and transferred everywhere else?
No, but it has a carryover.
Through the package.
But what's the nature of it if it's carryover? I mean, according to this Rav Hanan, it's perfect. The same way when it comes to the Svara.
In the first place.
Oh. So, first of all, happens to be the Rav Hanan was working Bidas Tosos in this, so it actually works out well. But he was trying to say the same Tosos who brings the Raya from exactly what you're saying, right. He's saying Pshana Tosos. Could be this is for other Rishonim, first of all. And as we saw already in and Reb Chaim, that it could very well be when it comes to like a hekesh that the, you know, we say like the mashal of dolminov ugiva asr, that sometimes the source and the destination are different. Even though you carry over halacha, the nature and the gedder of it is different. So even within Tosos, there's room to say that the nature, when it's applied to gilarayos, it's different than when it comes to the sar. Okay, so right, Adkan, we had the two approaches, right? The first approach, again, is that you're not, the avera, it does not accrue to you. It's as if you didn't perform the avera. Second approach is that it's like the stalemate. You're frozen, you just can't take a stand. And the third approach, which is found in Rishonim, this is an interesting idea. This is found in the Milchamas and in Muki Yosef. Anyone want to remember what they said? Brian, remember you were talking about it? In terms of what the svar of the Muki Yosef and the Milchamas is for Karka Olam?
Yeah. If it's passive avera, it doesn't make sense to say you should be killed rather than violated, because they could force you to do the avera at the end of it anyway.
Exactly.
So therefore, it doesn't make sense to kill.
Exactly. So explain. Exactly right. According to, we'll see, both in the Muki Yosef and the Milchamas, they offer a third svara. Not that the avera is not misyachis to you, and it's not that it's a stalemate, but rather that because the avera could be violated passively, they say that's a siman, that's an indication that since the avera can be violated passively, that means they could also force you to violate the avera. Once they could force you to violate the avera, says the Nimuki Yosef and Milchamas, there's no point in you giving up, let's say, the Isha. There's no point of her giving up her life in order not to violate the Avera, if, even if she decides to give up her life, they can still, before killing her, they can force her to violate the Avera anyways. And then, what did you gain? Not only do you die, but the Avera is also violated. So basically, there's no, according to this third approach, there's no value in, or there's no value in giving up your life in order to save, to protect the violation from the Avera, if the Avera itself can be violated whether or not you agree to it.
I mean, theoretically, it's always able to be forced, but not necessarily in every situation.
Cool.
What?
It's only theoretically able to be forced upon them, right?
I mean, when, let's say, Karka Olam by an Isha.
Right.
Since she could be forced, right, the man who's putting a gun to her head could force her. Meaning, it doesn't meaning Bia doesn't require her participation.
She could always be dead. I mean, it could be a gun. Like, she could, I don't know. Is it
necrophilia?
What do you mean force?
So the point is, the point is that since you're protested, I'm going to kill you, but before I kill you, I'm going to have the Bia with you anyways.
I mean, she could resist, and the only way to stop is him shooting.
But what they're saying is that it could very well be that he's going to be able to force her to do it anyway. Again, there are always going to be circumstances. But the point is that because it's... the point is, whenever something is karka olam, and we'll read the Lashonos inside, something is karka olam, that means it doesn't require that person's active participation. It doesn't require their active participation. In most cases, that means that the avera can be violated, can be forced upon you, even without your consent. So therefore, they're therefore saying that the only reason to do an Avera in order, you know, in a clash between V'chai Behem and the Avera is that, at least you're going to have, to do the Avera is that at least you're going to be able to have V'chai Behem. And
I'm saying that, like, take the case with the growing on top of the baby, right? So he's saying, like, either I'm going to, like, do it or I'll shoot you. But it's going to, if he resists, then it's going to be, like, pretty hard for the guy to, like, he'll end up probably having to shoot him, because it's going to be hard to take someone resisting, throw him on top of him, like...
So,
unless he, like, knocks him on the head and he falls down on the baby.
But it's just two guys, you know?
Again, you can always come up with cases, but the clown that they're saying is that because there's a good chance, or because there's a chance, you have to figure out what the numbers are, but there's what?
In that case,
But as long as...
Say, because there's a chance...
Because there's a chance that the Avera will be violated anyways, even if you opt to die, when you opt to die, what have you gained? The whole point of dying is to prevent the violation of the Avera.
It's going to happen after the guy dies, he's going
to... No, I think they assume, let's say to the woman, they assume that, if you protest, then I'm going to bebowl you and then kill you. Take your question. I know you seem to be right.
So then it's just like, we might as well
give in. and save your life. You know, the whole point is a clash of values. There's the chai behem and the avera.
Right.
So the whole point of violating, right, the whole point of dying when it comes to the big three is that at least you'll save the avera. But if here, there's a good chance that even if you opt for b'chai ben, right, even if you opt for dying, that the avera is going to be violated anyways, then both are going to happen. Before we take any more questions, I want to read the Lashonos in the Rishonim.
Who is that?
We'll see. The Mechamis in Sanhedrin. It is Yud Zayin Aveis B'dapi Arif. And the Muki Yosef there. So just the Mechamis is the Ramban, right? First says, less clear, but I think is also hinting at this. Mechamis is Lashon in like six or seven words. And he's describing the Petur of Kark Olam. He says, Me'acher she'echolin livol osa al karcha. Since they can force her to be Baal anyways. That's Muhammad. Again, that's his explanation of why is it that Karka Olam is Pater? Why should you just give in? Because they can force her to do it anyways. That's Muhammad. Miki Yosef, even clearer, spells the whole thing out. This is in Sanhedrin. I put it on the Marmar Kamas. So Miki Yosef says as follows. Again, this is Yud Zayin Aviz, B'Dapi Arif. He says as follows. Hada amrinan karka olam, that which we say that you should, you know, violate the avera when you're passive, lefi sheyecholin lachuf osa al kach bal karcha, because they are able to force her to violate the avera against her will anyways, ubechiha, and therefore in such a scenario, ein la limsor atzma lemisa, there's no point of her giving up her life, shari efshir sha'afilu timtsor atzma, even if she opts for death, still yachofu osa. They still will just force her, lidvar avera. I'm assuming, and then just kill her. B'chi agavna shari, and therefore in such a situation, you might as well just violate the avera. B'afilu b'shlosha averas chamuros. So again, that seemed, again, if there are any alternative reads in the Vishranam, please let me know, but it seems to be pretty clear, for sure than Muki Yosef, I think even in the Ramban, that this is the approach that they're adopting.
Yeah. But according to this view, the woman's intention, her choice, doesn't matter.
In what sense?
The whole premise behind the clash of values leading to the stalemate is that the...
That's not this approach, right?
I know that, yeah. But I mean this approach sort of makes a mockery of the idea of the mitzvah actually being addressed to anybody, right? The whole point of the clash of values is that your will is being pulled in
two choices.
Directions.
Mm-hmm.
And because both directions are intolerable, you make no choice and let the chips fall as they may.
That's right.
Exactly.
Right. This approach, there's no different... This approach posits no difference between the... this approach says that the woman being raped against her will... The woman being raped even though she... This approach says that the outcome of the woman being raped... even though she protests, is not, which is to say, doesn't opt for the masa, the maisa, the avera, is not preferable to her, consenting to the
both options. It's clear that it's onus. Right? It's very,
what?
Very clear. No matter what, when there's a gun to your head, she's not violating the Aveira, Baratzen, willingly, voluntarily. And either way, the status of her Aveira is onus, is involuntary, under duress, against her will. So that's going to be the status of her violation. What this approach is basically saying is that generally, let's say by your Bodhisattva, the gun to your head, either bow down to the idol, or you're going to get killed. So there's a clash of values, because either you can violate the Aveira, on the one hand, or you can be killed. So it's a is a clash of values between life and the other. So you have to choose. But here we're saying, it's not a one-on-one clash. It's really a one versus two, because either way you go, the Avera could be violated.
But in one case you're willing it.
But it's not a willing, but halachically, that's what I'm saying. That's how I neutralized it before. Even when you consent by not fighting, halachically, we still consider you, the Isha, to be non-consenting under duress.
Because you're forced under duress.
Exactly.
But this is the stalemate option.
No.
So you actually, in this case, you affirmatively choose.
No, it's because we're saying that in a vacuum, the value of the Avera would trump life. Right? If you were to have a situation, let's say Avodah Zarah, where it was either the Avera or life, we would say, give up your life because the value of the chomer, the severity of the Avera, trumps the value of your life. And it's only here in the situation of Karka Olam where, on both sides of the ledger, no matter what you do, the Avera will be violated.
But there's all the differences.
So therefore, it's a two versus one. Because if you fight, so then two things will happen. You lose your life, and the Avera will be violated. On the other hand, just the Avera will be violated. And if you ask, the severity of the Avera on both sides are not even, I'm going to say, it is. Because once there's a gun to your head, halachically, you're in the category of onus, of under duress. So the onus of having fought physically, or the onus of just giving in because the gun to your head, halachically, that's the same.
Why can't you learn that in cold? It's a stalemate.
That's not this approach.
This is just saying
that's not true. There's no stalemate. Really, the Avera outweighs your life.
Why doesn't this apply to the other Avera? So here's how it would apply. It could apply very easily.
And to non-carpal?
Sure. It could apply to murder. It could apply to murder.
Yeah, in a case where it's not carpal olam, though.
Sure.
They say, take this gun and shoot the other person, or I'm going to shoot you.
No.
There, the Avera of you killing the other person cannot happen unless they can't force you to
do it. On the contrary, of course they can. They can put the gun in your hand.
But if you decide to die, you're going to die and not the other person.
Why not? Hold on a minute. Okay, fine. In the case of Avodah Zarah, they can literally force you to your knees.
That's not possible.
You have to poop on the thing.
There's a lot of cases, and let's be mature.
Okay,
yeah. It's a specific type of. It's irrelevant.
Give up.
That's irrelevant to the matter at hand. When it comes to Avodah Zarah, it comes to your head. Bow down to this,
right?
Or you're gonna die.
Why can't they force you to your knees?
Because if the only force is with a gun, if you say I'm gonna die, the act of Avodah Zarah will not be violated. If they push you down, not Avodah Zarah.
That's SBU. You're telling you to do it.
It's your physical act of bound.
There's a different status.
Or anything which is defined as karka olam. Quentin told us it's being thrown at a baby.
It's the
same thing.
That's exactly what we had before.
Let's finish. Anything which is defined as karka olam means that they could do the Avera with you, even against your will. And therefore, the Yerushalmim say, what's the point of giving up your life if, even if you opt for giving up your life, it could very well be that not only are they going to take your life, but they're also going to cause the Avera to be violated. So therefore, you might as well just violate the Avera, because then at least you save a life. It's two versus one.
But isn't the whole point of Karka Olam
that you will be violating, because that is going to be an act of Gila Raios.
If you don't do anything, it should be an Avera.
No, that's the point is, we'll get to this, the role of an Isha by Bia is passive.
So therefore, why Karka Olam anyway? What's the role of Karka Olam if not to cancel out the Avera that would otherwise exist?
So that was the first approach. This other side to say is that now, even if it's a Karka Olam, the Avera will be violated. It's just, the whole point is that, but they can force you to do the Avera anyways, so therefore it's not a clash of one versus one, it's a clash between one versus two, and you might as well opt for one versus two.
But you can't have both. You can't be both Karka Olam and an Avera.
That's not true. because at the end of the day,
then there's one of those things.
But it's an avera.
I feel as though one of these concepts has to be emptied of content in this.
No.
Why?
No, it's under ones. But at the end of the day,
so how can it be an avera? I just don't understand.
That the avera is being violated. We're asking.
So it's a guiltless
event. No, yeah.
So it's a guiltless
event. No matter what, there's a gun to your head.
Wait a minute, so it's a guiltless event.
Yeah.
Of course
it's guiltless.
So there shouldn't be... Wait. So there shouldn't be any difference. If it's a guiltless avera...
By the end of the day, God doesn't want that to be violated. And that's why we say, even though it's guiltless, when it comes to the big three, we generally say... We'd rather you give up your life and violate it, even guilt-free. And therefore, because of that din, the halacha is you can't violate the avera. Therefore, if you have a choice,
right.
You have a choice. When it comes to karka olam, the point is that even though you're being forced,
right.
Or because you're being forced, we're going to say, you might as well give in, don't protest, because if you protest, then not only will the avera be violated, but you'll also kill you. I don't want... We're going to have to go... We can spend time afterwards.
Could I ask you something?
Yes. But after this, I'm gonna have to go on.
What happens if there's a guy and he's... Is this going to be inappropriate? This stuff is also appropriate.
What?
Everything I've said is appropriate.
Everything has to be formulated in an appropriate manner.
I used a very minor language
Last straw. Yeah?
So basically, what happens if the guy, if the guy that he tells him to kill is can be executed anyway?
That's a separate question. That will change the dynamic because that might not be considered an act of ritual.
The last one used chefza, right?
What?
The last shot used like the whole chefza thing, right?
That was for Reb Chaim.
But that fit in, no?
Partially.
Isn't that wouldn't cause our sort of pain to that the second phase?
The COVID virus is still on me?
And then you become...
Yeah, but I don't call it a chetza. You just have to remain passive. I think that's a little different.
Okay.
So Arkan, okay, get you fired up. It's always good. So we basically discuss what's the nature of the tour of Karka Olam when it comes to the Gimel Averos Chomeros. Again, three approaches. Number one, it's as if you didn't do the Avera. Right, number two, which you seem to like now, on my friend. I retroactively seem to.
That what?
You basically.
Did I flip?
No, you didn't express exuberance at the time, but at the end you're basically saying that you like the first approach. That when you're completely passive, it doesn't accrue to you.
Yeah, I just. Okay? The thing is formulated to be apparent.
I shouldn't have said that, but I'm just saying you should be exuberant.
Okay.
Retroactively. My first approach is that as if you didn't do the Avera. Second approach is that, right, stalemate, it's a freeze. Third approach is that because it could be done anyways, there's no value in giving up your life. So that was all in terms of the Gimel Averos Chomeros. Now transitioning quickly, just take 2 seconds, in terms of the realm of Farhasya, where the Gemara, is actually where Abaye in Sanhedrin mentions the Patur of Karka Olam for the first time. In terms of understanding what is the role of Karka Olam when it comes to Chil Hashem and for Hasya, so just 2 quick ways to understand that. So the simplest way to say is that, there is less, basically the fact that the person is violating it passively mitigates against the Chil Hashem. Right? There's much less Chil Hashem when the Avera is being violated. Passively. I'll say that's a simple idea. And the second option is to say, perhaps, that even Chil Hashem, when it comes to, like an Avera, or in the context of Yahar Layav, the Chil Hashem is that you, by violated any of the Averos, at the threat of someone who's coming against Yadus. So it could be, it's not, right, the first approach is that simply the fact that you did it passively, that, mitigates, that neutralizes the Chil Hashem. I think the second approach is to say, similar to the first approach we had earlier, is that even within the realm of Chil Hashem, perhaps the Chil Hashem is only triggered by the violation of the Avera. And therefore it could be, just like the first approach, that when you do it passively, you don't consider it as if you violated the Avera, So it could be that that also ends up neutralizing the Chil Hashem. According to the second approach, the Chil Hashem only comes about when there is an Avera which is violated before Hasya. But if you think that the Avera isn't violated when you do it passively, so it could be that the factor of the way Karka Olam neutralizes the Chil Hashem, it's not just, oh, because generally an Avera violated passively has less Chil Hashem, but that an Avera violated passively is not an Avera. Once there's no Avera, Mimela, there's no Chil Hashem. Yeah.
Is there a Chil Hashem by Maris
Ayin?
Could we call Maris Ayin a case of Chil Hashem?
Yeah, so that's a big discussion within the Yehari Le'avor Sugya.
So I'm saying, if that would be true, then even though there's no Avera, per se, so we can still say it's Chil Hashem.
So this gets back to what we were discussing this morning, about whether there's Maris Ayin, if there actually isn't something going on. Because what they're seeing is something passive, and if what you're seeing, and when something happens, you remember the sense of immersion?
Yeah, if the chabit's passive, then it's maybe the opposite. That what they're seeing will take away from the Chil Hashem.
Exactly.
Wait, what? If no Avera was done, so let's say you're not being forced, did you want to do an Avera passively?
Well, how do you do an Avera passively?
A woman tells a man that to have to be with her, it's just there.
So we'll get there. I mean, we're going to get to that issue in just a moment.
We'll get to that.
Meaning, that's going to be a question that if you always consider an Isha to be Karka Olam, so then why is she ever Chayevas for Gila Raios if she doesn't write it.
Always we should do nothing.
If the second
approach uses that passively isn't really like whatever, so why not just use that for the first, for their explanation of what what's it called, this Karka Olam is?
We just gave two explanations for what is the reasoning behind Karka Olam when it comes to Chil Hashem.
Right.
So the first thing is just, oh, when it's passive violation has less Chil Hashem. The other approach, which is parallel to the first approach by the Gimel Averos Chamuros, is that just like the first approach by Gimel Averos Chamuros said, oh, but Malkum Karka Olam, there's just no violation of the Avera. So you're saying the same thing here. If you assume that the Chil Hashem is only through the violation of the Avera, and if you think that the Karka Olam neutralizes the violation of the Avera, that thereby Memela neutralizes the Chil Hashem, assuming the Chil Hashem.
And that's what the Chalakis and that Esther.
Perhaps. Maybe we're just giving you, yeah, we're just giving you
another
chance.
Can I get my own understanding?
Yeah.
That is that in the case of Karka Olam,
yeah,
you're actually supposed to do the Avera. So how would it be a Chil Hashem? Right?
One more time?
In the case of Karka Olam, right? Not for Hasya, Karka Olam. We're supposed to actually do the Avera, correct? Is the correct thing to do?
No, that's circular. We're trying to understand why are you supposed to do the Avera?
No, not by Hasya. In a regular case, we get aroused. Right?
Yeah. Are you, according to those who hold the Torah Karka Olam?
Yeah.
The question is why?
By another time, we already know why by Gila Arias. By Gila Arias, we know why it's allowed.
There's three opinions.
Right, so the reason would be for Hasya would be allowed because since you're allowed to do the Avera now, right? So there's no Chil Hashem.
There's a new factor. Farhesia says, okay, perhaps, okay, granted you've solved, let's say, the Avera itself, but this is a new factor of Farhesia. There's a new factor of Chil Hashem.
But there's no Chil Hashem. You're doing the right thing. We tell you, you're doing what you have to do. In other words, you have a chiyuv to do the Avera.
We're trying to understand why. Why are you supposed to do the Avera?
Because
what do you mean, there's a Chil Hashem?
It's not a Chil Hashem because you're doing the right thing.
But why is it the right thing?
I think
it's a little circular, just because we're trying to understand, whenever something is done before Hesia, there's a new factor of Chil Hashem. So you have to mitigate, you have to neutralize that factor of Chil Hashem in order for it to be mutter. So if you're trying to say, oh, the Karka Olam makes it mutter, the question is why? So if you say, like, first, oh, just the fact that it's Karka Olam, you know, neutralizes the Chil Hashem, that's one thing. Or if you say, which I think you're getting at also, is that, no, when it's Karka Olam, there's no Avera, and once there's no Avera, that thereby undermines the Chil Hashem. That's a second.
Is the first and second different?
Yeah, because one, the first approach is has nothing to do with the Maisa Avera. Chil Hashem has nothing to do with the Maisa Avera. Right, and therefore, it's just saying that even if it considers if you did an Avera, the Karka Olam, passively, still, there's less Chil Hashem associated with the fact that you just did it passively. You didn't actively go against the religion. You were just passive, therefore, even though you're still defined as doing the Avera, it's still, there's not enough Chil Hashem to be Mechayev Yehar Le'Avor. The second approach assumes that no, the Makom Makarka Olam, when it's passive, it's as if you didn't do the Avera. That's assumption number one. And assumption number two, that there only is a Chil Hashem when there actually is an Avera.
I'm just wondering, maybe you could say Yudas Pshat after you say one of those two. In which case, then there's a reason to for her to be over it. And then, I guess, instead of using Yudas Lashon, you use like Lashon Ram at the very beginning of when you are over a Nine Yaharik, so then that's a human in the Gash Bezo Kanei Israel, and therefore there's like Lekha of Shalashem.
Well, of course, there's no Chil Hashem.
But generally, I'm saying, but generally, when it comes to this particular, I mean, generally, by Farhesa, every mitzvah, you have to be Yehar Le'Avor for. So why, for that same mitzvah, when it's Karka Olam, does the dynamic change?
I'm saying that's why you use one of these two first. I'm saying then that those two brings starts it off, and then I think
okay, that's sort of yeah. Okay,
forward.
That's parallel to the second that's, idea that you know, but, no, the idea of Karka Olam that it neutralizes the other.
This is
once
you neutralize, maybe I don't know.
That's automatic.
This is taking the. This is that if there's not a Chil Hashem because there's not a Avera. This is just saying then that because there's no Avera there, so the. Therefore, we would say Yahareg, and therefore, and once we say Yahareg, then we say and then we say that it's not a contradiction for Hesia.
Mm-hmm. That's something bad. Okay, just moving on a little bit. Cause,
can I just like ask a Matthias like question? Uh-huh. How can a woman protest, a passive whatever? Just like, what is she going to do? Is she going to say no?
Well, that's sort of at the Ramban. That's what the Ramban and the Yosef were saying. Yeah. That you can force it anyways.
That was the third.
Right, and also, I think, you can say, Rav Elkan is also saying that.
I think from a slightly different... what you're saying right now is very similar to the Ramban. Is that you can't... At the end of the day, it's not under your control about whether this Avera...
And it's garnish what you do.
Yeah, exactly. Your role in this is not going to change...
So according to the Nuka Yosef, he's saying that there is a way that you can protest, but it would only come to harm you in the end.
Well, there's no way to protest to prevent the violation of the Avera.
There's no way.
The only thing your protest will do is perhaps get you killed.
Right.
That's what he's saying.
But I'm just asking, I guess.
But I think your question just gets into that. She'll scream. It's like, oh, you're annoying. Meaning, you're putting up a fight. I told you not to. I'll kill you afterwards. That's what Muki Yosef is assuming. Okay. Fine. So now, one last issue within Karka Olam is the question of whether the role of an Isha, when it comes to Bia, is that always defined as Karka Olam? Or are there circumstances where an Isha could also be considered Kumba Aseh and not Karka Olam? So basically the question is, when we apply Karka Olam to Nashim, does that apply in every single case of an Isha when it comes to Bia, or only in certain circumstances?
That depends on which of the three you go.
Not necessarily.
With your understanding of Karka Olam by Farhesia, any relationship to your understanding of it by Gimal Yeros and Moros, independent?
It was independent. The second suggestion I gave for the Farhesia related to the first suggestion by Yeros and Moros. There was a connection in terms of that, but it doesn't have to be. Well, according to the first pshat by Farhesia, there's no connection. It's just like a din of Chil Hashem that there's less Chil Hashem by when you're passive. Oh. So you probably could tell when I was introducing this, there are two different approaches in the Rishonim about this question. The first approach basically says that...
No.
Depends how you formulate the question. But the first approach basically says that the role of an Isha when it comes to Bia is always defined as Karka Olam. According to this approach, you will never find, right, the Girsa when it comes to Yehari Vayavar, when it comes to Gila Raya, always has to be Yehari Vayavar, focus on the man. It can never be Tehari Bal Tavor, because the exception of Karka Olam applies in every single case. Because every Bia that an Isha is involved in, according to this first approach, is considered Karka Olam, and therefore Tehar Bal Tavor never applies to Nashim. So just in terms of the just to document the Shitas who hold this.
Because there's no Tavor. They always be
because she, when it comes to Gila Raios, she never should be killed.
There's no Tavor for which...
There's never Tehari. She should never be killed.
because there's no, because she would be committing no sin.
Oh, well, that depends on what the shot. That's
she,
really
the only reason why you wouldn't be killed. The only reason why you, the only reason why she would never be, why she would never opt to be killed, is if by not being killed, she wouldn't be committing an avera.
So that was the three shots I gave earlier. That was the first shot. My second shot's like the stalemate idea.
Right.
I'm saying, so just insert that earlier analysis into here, but now coming from just a different angle, just is a woman always considered karkaola when it comes to B? So according to the first approach,
You're talking about any of the arayas.
So just in terms of to quickly document, you know, the shitos, first you have the Rashi, the bottom Rashi on Pei Beis Amud Aleph. If you see that Rashi, when it comes to when the Gemara is discussing the Har Vayavar by Gila Arayos, see, do you want to ask Afna or Marasa? Brian, you want to go for it? Too long.
Afna Marasa, in Yomru, Bavala, Rusas, Habirecha, Kari, if it be with the Rus of your friend, they killed Yar Vayavar.
All right, Yehare.
Yehare Vayavar. Bahi, Hinam, and Suva, Lumsar's Nashem.
So again, this simple understanding of Rashi. Rashi, again, he's not explicit on the matter, but Rashi says is that this Yehar Bayavar in the context of Gila Rayos applies to the Ish, to the person, but when it comes to her, she's Karkola. So again, you don't know for sure just based on this Rashi whether that's always the case. Again, it seems like it because he seems pretty black and white. It applies to the man. It doesn't apply to the Isha. But you don't know for sure. If you look at Tosfos, Tosfos quotes Rashi. That's what I have in mind. All right, so if you see the beginning of Tosfos, Tosfos quotes Rashi, seemingly coming off of this Rashi and saying, Rashi holds that Karka Olam always applies, and therefore that you should never have the Girsa of Tehara Egbal Tavor. So Brian, you want to read the beginning of Tosfos?
Yeah,
Pirush Rashi.
Pirush Rashi, the little girl is the Harig. The Elam Mechayv, Elam Shanash, the Karkolam.
Oh, stop there. Right? So basically, the way Tosas interprets Rashi is that there never is Teharig Baal Tavor for the Isha because she's always defined as Karkolam. So similarly to this Rashi and Tosas B'Shem Rashi is the first daya in the Tosas Psachim Chafayon Beis. Right? The first daya in Tosos there similarly says that Karka Olam always applies to Nashim, therefore don't be gores the girsa of Teharig Baal Tavor, it's always Teharig Vayavar because the Isha is always considered Karka Olam. So those are just the two basic shittos hold this. Now just to analyze.
Is the Tosos in
Psachim, Chaf Hayom Abyss, Dibra Maschol Af, the top Tosos.
The two basic ones, the other one?
Rashi.
Okay.
I mean Rashi and the first day in Tosos and Psachim. Those are the two shittos who hold this first approach.
Okay.
Right? So, so just to explain, very important. So, according to this first approach, that an Isha is always, under all circumstances, is always considered Karka Olam, that assumes that she's even considered Karka Olam when she, as we'll see the example given by the later Rishonim, even if she physically, you know, initiates the Bia. Even if she, as Tosos gives the case, even if she brings the man upon her, she's still considered passive, Karkola. So the question... Let me finish, and then we'll take questions. So, the question is, what exactly is going on? She brings the man upon her, which is, kumbase, that's active, but yet, she's defined as passive. So I think the way to conceptually analyze, you know, the case at hand, is that you have a preparation, you have a hechsher, and then you have the Maisa itself. So you have a Hechsher, and then a Maisa. So the Maisa is always passive. Right? And according to the Maisa Bia itself, the Isha plays a passive role. In the situation at hand, when she takes an active role in initiating it, you have a case where the Hechsher, the preparation, is active, and the Maisa itself is passive. So I think what's going on here is a fundamental, interesting machlokes about whether that active preparation redefines the maisa itself. And according to this first approach, the fact that she was played an active role in the preparation does not spill over, does not carry over to redefine the Maisa itself. And because the Maisa, in regards to the Maisa itself, and Isha is passive, nothing that she does in preparation for the Maisa could render the Maisa itself active. We're going to contrast this with the next approach, which we'll see in just a moment, who argue that no, that when the preparation is active, that redefines the entire process as being active as well. Just before, I just want to finish a little bit more, and then we'll take all questions. Just one other issue within this first approach, which I think Yehuda raised before, is that if, according to this first approach, an Isha is always considered passive, right, she's never defined as performing a Maisa, so then the question is going to be, so then why, let's say she has Bio with someone Baratzon, she's over Arayos, Baratzon, so why is she Chayv Misa? She didn't do a Maisa.
Maybe it's a different way.
No, so the Gemara in Baba Kama, exactly as Moshe is saying, the Gemara in Baba Kama, Lamed Beis, Amar Aleph, this is cited by Tosfos, basically says it's the Hana, which is Mechayev.
Baba Kama, what was it?
Lamed Beis, Amar Aleph. So the Gemara there focuses on the Hana in describing, you know, the Mechayev of, you know, for an Isha in her role of Bia. So like there are two ways to understand what exactly does that mean. And if she's not defined as having a Maisa, what is Hana, how does Hana change the equation? So there are two different options. One is to say that, actually I'll flip the order, probably a little easier. One option is to say that the Hana itself is the Mechayev. That the Chiddush, when it comes to the Chiyah Misa for an Isha, for Arayos, is that the Koveya, the determining factor for the Chiyah Misa, is not her having performed a Maisa, because she can never perform a Maisa, but it's rather the Hana. And that if she receives Hana through Bia with an Erva, that is Mechayev. It's according to the first option, the Mechayev is the Hana that she receives, even though she's not defined as having performed a Maisa.
Can she receive Hana involuntarily?
No, this is the case where
she's receiving the Hana, she's still passive.
Yeah. According to this first approach, even though she's passive, and she's not defined as being active, there's no Maisa accruing to her, but because she was Baratzon, because this is a case where she wants to be, she wants to be Mazan.
Is there any, like,
she wants to be Mazan. The question just we're answering is that once you consider Isha is always passive, so then how you can have a Mechayev does it voluntarily. So we're saying the Gemara Baba Kama focuses on the factor of Hana. So we're trying to understand what exactly is the role of Hana.
Wait.
So one approach is to say that the Mechayev of Misa is the Hana itself. Right? And generally, Averos, your Chayev for your Chayev Misa for Averos, your Chayev Onshin, when you do a Maisa Avera. Here the Chiddush is, since there's no Maisa to speak of, that the Mechayev is the Hana.
It's done willingly.
It's all willingly.
I mean, like, is there any example of any, you know, do we have any?
We'll get there. The second option, it's not that the Mechayev is the Hana itself, but rather that when she is doing it voluntarily and she's getting Hana, that connects her to the Maisa itself. And so not that, like the first option, the Hana itself is the Mechayev, but rather, to use Lomdisha terms, the Hana is the Mitzarev, the Hana connects her to the Maisa. And when she is deriving Hana from that Maisa, that dictates that now the Maisa accrues to her. Exactly, Moshe is saying, because the drasha, the Gemara itself, focuses on the lashon of the pasuk of osos. And seems to connect Hana to the fact that she's now defined as being a partner. So one more thing, then I'll take questions. These two options, whether you focus on the Hana itself as the Mechayev, or whether the Hana is the Mitzarev, connects the person to the Maisa, seems to be, and you're asking where you ever have this type of, you know, concept elsewhere, is a well-known concept in halacha called misasik b'chalav v'arayos chayev shekein nehne. I'll break that down. Generally, the concept of misasik, right, when you do an action, you do an avera totally without knowledge of it. You know, the classic example is Shabbos, you brush against the wall and the light goes on. You're completely unaware that you're doing the action. That's called misasik. So generally, misasek b'chol Torah kula is a patur. You're completely patur. But the Gemara says there are two exceptions. Exception number one It's called chalavim, literally chalav, fats. Machalas asuros, forbidden foods. The other exceptions is arayos. The Gemara justifies, so why is there no patura of misasek when it comes to machalas asuros and bia? Shekin nehne. Because you got hanah from it.
For a man.
Anyway, let me finish. So that's the concept. There's no patur of misasek, shekinen. So again, the two approaches in the Mefarshim to that idea. So, what do you mean? You're misasek, similarly. Misasek generally means that you're not connected to the maaseh because you know awareness of it. So why all of a sudden, because you got hana, are you now chayev? So again, the two approaches which parallel these are exactly what we said. One approach is say, oh, the uniqueness of machalas, asuros, and bia, that the machayev is not the maisa. The machayev is the hana. And the other approach is that, no, the machayev really is the maisa, but when it's shekeinene, when you derive benefit from it, that benefit connects you to the maisa. So ordinarily, the factor which connects you to a maisa is your das, is your awareness of you're doing the maisa. But here, there's another connector. That even if you're not aware that you're doing the ma'isa, the fact that you derive benefit from the ma'isa, that is what connects you to the ma'isa. So again, these two approaches to the mechayev of hana, or to the concept of an isha being chayev for bia, when she does it baratzon, whether it's the hana is mechayev or the hana is mitzarev, connects you to the ma'isa, are the two general approaches to understanding the exception of chalav and arayos to the concept of misasek. Yeah.
So even if it's not willingly, there still should be the hana should still attach her.
So the assumption seems to be that when it's done against her will, there's no hana.
So what about the man?
There's no hana?
Yeah.
And with the man, it doesn't reply because the man is always going to get hana.
You talking about bia?
By karkaola or.
But yeah, that's a separate sugya in the Yevamos Dom Gimel of Ein Kishoy El Ladas that basically says that a man's role in the Maisa Bia, because the Kishoy is considered a Maisa, that even when he's being forced to, as long as the Kishoy is the Das, therefore that's considered a Maisa. That's a whole separate sugya. We're not going to get into that now.
With what you said, that answer, so then it could be
Which answer?
That, what's it called?
The Hanoz Machai, where they connect?
The assumption is that there is never enough in this case.
Oh, I mean to, right. I mean to, yeah. Onis, yeah.
So, can't the first approach that she's always Karka Olam really be? It's really like the second approach that there's sometimes Karka Olam, just that they're arguing about whether it's possible to have Hana.
I'm thinking because Hana is different than Karka Olam.
I know, but
Karka Olam is whether she's in a Maisa. So this Hana fact, again, I mean, like physically, I mean, do we consider her to have physically done?
But the approach that said that there's no karka olam when there's hana.
Because the hana makes it into a maisa, you're
saying? Right, so it's the same thing, it's just that it doesn't.
Yeah, I hear what you're saying, but I think when they say that a karka olam always applies, it means absent hana, absent, you know, external factors, and in terms of her physical role, we always deem her physical role as being passive. A separate factor of hana is it's like a side way of, you know, dictating that the maisa is going to, you know, be mitzuruf to her, but it still doesn't.
But if there was, she wouldn't be passive.
It sounds like the Ramban to me.
Is that what?
What did you say?
But if there was hana, then she wouldn't be passive.
But again, she's still completely passive, but just halachically, we say that the maisa is accrued to her.
That's right.
So again, it's, you're right, bottom line, the maisa will be on her record, but at the end of the day, she's still a karka olam who's only chayiv because the hana is mitzarif.
So I mean,
it's not the which part?
Like, how? If that's what's mitzarif.
The general way to get a maisa accrued to you is when you do the maisa. Right? When you actively do a maisa.
Okay.
That's the general way. This chiddush of shekeinene or hana is that there's an alternative track to connect you to a maisa. That's like an exception to karka olam.
Once you do the alternative track, shouldn't that be, shouldn't you yarug layavur there?
The yarug layavur, there's no hana when it comes to the yarug layavur case.
Maybe that's
what you're saying, because the yarug layavur is a case where it's onus. We assume there's no hana in those cases.
That's
what you're answering in the other case. The hana is only going to apply if she was baratzon. So that factor is never going to apply in the cases of karka olam when it comes to yarug layavur.
Okay.
Maybe that's a shot in the Ramban, who says that in a case where she, so to speak, likes the guy.
We won't get to that right now. Hold on. Okay, so this is also, I kept you guys from the Moser last time. I can't do that again. So let's just quickly finish the second approach. And with that, we'll close. And the second approach is that although there are certain cases where an isha is defined as karka olam, there are other circumstances, there are certain circumstances where the isha will not be defined as karka olam. And therefore, according to the second approach, there could be the girus of teharag matavar could apply, because there are some certain cases where if she is not karka olam, she's going to be subject to the chiyuv of teharag matavar. So the first version of this, called 2a, is the second daya in the Tosos Pesachim Chafei. I'm going to point out the first daya was according to the first approach. The second daya in Tosos Pesachim there, Chafei Amabez, holds that the case where the Isha physically pulls the man on top of her, in such a case, she is not defined as Karka Olam, and therefore, in that case, the din of Tehari Bal Tabor will apply to her. And as we pointed out before, the analysis is that according, there again, the machlokes between these two different deos is whether a kumba asay hechsher preparation redefines the sheval taisa maisa. The first day I held, she's always karka olam, even in such a circumstance, because the hakdam, right, that preparation, that hechsher, does not carry over. According to the second day, if she, right, takes an active role in the preparation of the bia, so then that preparation will redefine the maisa itself, and that's why it's not karka olam in such a situation. Just that parallel, which is an interesting marmakon, this conceptual, you know, framework of a hechsher redefining the maisa, here we're saying in the context of averos, this also comes up in the context of mitzvos, where there's an avnei nezer in the context of tkiya shofar, who basically says that the reason why is a big issue in terms of the gedder of the mitzvah of tkiya shofar. Some say it's just the shmia, right? Some say it's just the hearing, and some say it's the tkiya, it's the blowing. There's the third group of rishonim who say it's both. So Avnei Nezer develops this idea that it's really both, and explains why is it both. He says it can't just be the shmia, because shmia is sheval taisa. And he says that's masasek. You can't have a mitzvah where you're not doing an action. Therefore he says you need the tkiya to be part of the mitzvah, because the tekiya is active, and then through the active tekiya, that will redefine the maisa of shemiyah.
What's shemiyah going at?
I don't want to get into it. That's still shemiyah going at, is still passive. So the Avnei Nezer is giving a parallel to this idea of the hechsher redefining the maisa. So here we have it, the second day of Tosos, of the hechsher to the bia, redefining the bia. You also have it on the flip side, and comes to mitzvos of a hechsher mitzvah, in that context, the ma'is tekiya, which is active, redefining the shmia, which is passive. Just again, that framework, this idea of a hechsher redefining the ma'isa. And the second version,
to be
exactly, is the Mechamas, is the Ramban, as you were just referencing before. So he says that the girsa of Tehari Val Tavor also makes sense in a certain circumstance. But instead of saying, oh, it's the case like Tosfos, where she takes an active role in the Hechsher, it's rather, Ramban says, as long as she has Kavana. As long as she wants the Bia to take place, she is not defined as Karka Olam.
She doesn't actually want, she's being forced.
Correct. If she's being forced, but she also wants it, or let's say, in this circumstance, she wants it to happen, but no, sorry. In this circumstance, she's being forced, but she wants it to happen.
Some like double.
So basically, what the Ramban is holding, in the, you know, he calls a hella libatina, when she, you know, has a crush on him, or she has interest, she has some interest in him. So in that case, the Macham is like a very bechidish that somehow no longer renders her a karka olam, because according to the Ramban, karka olam is not just your physical participation in the avera, but also your kavana and your willingness to go along with it. And according to the Ramban, the only time the karka olam applies is not only when you're physically passive, but also when in your mind, your kavanos, you do not want it to happen. But in a case where you're being completely passive, but you want it to happen, in such a circumstance, even an isha will not be defined as karka olam, which is a very important chiddush. So I guess we'll stop here and we'll pick up next time with B.S. Akam of Shitas Rebbeinu Tam. Take any questions? Anyone wants to go to Mustard? Sorry, now.
So, according to, yes. I want to say...